Okay, folks, you're listening to the latest chapter, the latest great adventure on Life on Planet Porky, and a very cold one, I have to say. Miss Jones, I have got my overcoat back on. I am treading on crispy grass as I walk across the North Downs. It's my sort of weather.
Do you know, I went to get in my car this morning. Yeah. I couldn't get the boot open. It was frozen. Frozen closed. And then I got in the car and, you know, you sit there trying to clear everything and stuff. And went, reached for my bottle of water that I keep in the car and went to take a little drink from it.
Yes.
And the water was frozen in the bottle.
My God, inside the car?
Inside the car. It was that cold this morning.
Do you know what? I remember years ago when I got my first Vauxhall Viva, when you woke up on mornings like this morning, you were terrified that your engine had frozen up. In those days, if you didn't put what's called antifreeze
right, yeah. that they used to put in wine at one point,
yes.
didn't they?
Yes, that's right, yeah. Unless you'd put antifreeze into your radiator around about November, and then when it came to sort of December, January, and it was freezing cold, you literally, your engine would freeze up and it would just wreck your engine, you know. So I was always very, very careful about the antifreeze. Of course, these days, certainly in my car, I can't even get to the engine now. I don't know about you, but if you ever lift the bonnet or the hood, as they call it in America, on the front of the car, you can't see the engine. There's a huge sort of plastic cover on it, and therefore there's nothing you can do if the anti-freezing measures are not in. I mean, for instance, did you ever have a car when you were younger, Miss Jones, where you had to actually get the dipstick, literally, an expression made famous by David Jason in Only Fools and Horses, right? But there was a dipstick. You had to take it out and then put it back into the hole, and you had to measure how much oil you had in your engine.
I think you still have a dipstick. But I have one, and it has a little yellow plastic kind of knob on the end, which if you feel your oil is running low, you're supposed to check it. I think that still is a thing. But antifreeze, I mean, I must have been way too young for that. But I can remember we had an Auntie Teresa when I was young, and she was known as Antifreeze.
Oh, really? Well, was she particularly cold-hearted or something?
She was lovely and warm, actually, but it was just that it sounded like Auntie Teresa.
Oh,
if you said it
Auntie
fast.
Teresa, Antifreeze, yeah, yeah.
Wasn't that funny, was it?
Well, no, it was. But, no, on the old oil, unless you're absolutely right, you should put in, but the antifreeze was always a terrible worry because you never really knew and helped people. But these days, certainly in my car, you switch, well, you only even switch the ignition on, it starts automatically as you get into the car, and then you have like a spaceship of images in front of you, you know, like the sort of flying deck of a jumbo jet 747. It tells you everything about your engine, i.e. where the oil is, where the antifreeze is and everything. And you just don't have to do anything. You know, it's just amazing. But anyway, there we go.
Well, cars are computers nowadays,
they
aren't they?
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt. Cars sometimes do things you don't want them to do because they're thinking for themselves. I mean, that's literally true, you know.
Just like men.
Well, there you go. Just like women sometimes, in my view, Miss Jones. But there you go. Now,
true enough.
Now, you've been working on an ABBA documentary. Our millions of listeners, Miss Jones, want to know all about this, please.
Oh, well, I thought I was making a programme for a Swedish television channel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did my research. I did my prep. I did all the things I usually do.
Yep.
I won't say I didn't take it that seriously because that would be unprofessional, but I didn't think it was a huge big deal. I didn't know that it was going to be seen all over the world on Amazon Prime Video.
Right.
Mm. I might have gone and bought a new frock had I known.
Well, hang on. It's not out yet, is it?
No. We filmed it actually today.
Okay.
And my friend Paul Gambaccini was in the last night.
Wow.
filming his bit. So, because I always ask, you know, who else are you talking to for these documents?
Yes, exactly.
And it always turns out there's a very small handful of us who follow each other around talking on these music documentaries and programs and so on.
Yeah.
But it was a very intelligent interview. It was hinged to the stalking factor, in fact, because I don't know whether you know, but Agneta, the beautiful blonde in the ABBA lineup.
I call her Agnetha, actually. I always have done since the...
Agnetha, whatever you want to call her. But you know the one I mean.
She married the man who stalked her, didn't she?
Well, she did, but it was very freaky, and she must have taken leave of her senses. Yeah, because we explore this in depth, you know, the whole sort of inequality of a stalking relationship. She wasn't the only person ever to have done that. I don't know if you remember Gary Newman, for example.
Yeah, Gary Newman, Cars.
Cars, that's right.
Yeah, I remember him, yeah.
Something like that. And he also married a woman who stalked him.
Really?
Justin Bieber is married to his wife, Hayley. She stalked him.
Really?
And you must, it's not confined to music stars either. You must remember when Liz Taylor married Larry Fortensky, the construction worker.
He was, yeah. He worked on a building site in New York, yeah.
And he stalked her. So I think it's a fairly common thing.
Really?
And I think people become addicted to that super level of attention and they mistake it for genuine real love until they come to their senses and realise that they've got involved with a psychopath.
Golly, it's amazing. Of course, there is a very downside to stalkers, like Jill Dando. Do you remember? She was murdered on the doorstep of her house.
Well, she was, but she wasn't stalked.
Well,
it was the first encounter, wasn't
it? It's never been worked out. It's never, ever been worked out who killed Jill Dando. Nobody knows, you know. And a guy was actually done who was linked to Queen, wasn't he? Wasn't he linked to Freddie Mercury in some way?
Barry, what was his Barry? Can't remember.
Well, he had the same surname as Freddie Mercury's original surname. Remarkably, I mean.
No, I don't think it was the same. Freddie's original surname was Bulsara.
Yeah.
It may have been something similar, but he did look a bit swarthy, a bit like Freddie as well.
Yeah.
And maybe he was a Queen fan or something.
Yeah, maybe something like that. But
he actually went down. He did time, didn't he?
He did. And then he was cleared, I think. I think we have to make that clear on Life on Planet Porky. The man now remains innocent and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, very, very kind of weird times. Miss Jones, as a woman, obviously, you have fears walking the streets, right? All women do. In fact, I couldn't believe until I got well into middle age how frightened women can be about being on their own, being on the street and that kind of stuff. But the latest revelations about the activity of the Metropolitan Police, and one in particular, are so appalling and so shocking that I am ashamed and utterly embarrassed to be a British citizen living in London with the Metropolitan Police allegedly regulating how we live.
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, which is the Met. The Metropolitan Police, as opposed to our wider national police force, we cannot tar hundreds of thousands of police officers with the same brush. Yes, we've had a terrible experience with Wayne Cousins, the murderer of Sarah Everard, not long ago. We have that awful situation with the police and how they handled Sarah's vigil in the park, didn't we? And then we had those inappropriate photos taken and shared by officers at the scene of Bieber Henry's and Nicholas Smallman's murders. Mm. And now it turns out we've had this serial rapist who's committed 48 rapes and strings of sadistic crimes over a period of about 20 years.
Yes.
How did this guy go unchecked? I tell you why, because his fellow officers, of whom he was a mate, were turning a blind eye and letting him off because he was one of theirs.
You're absolutely right. I've watched so many interviews, you know, over the last 24 hours about how this could have happened. And, you know, some expert came on about police behaviour and they said, well, the thing is that a mate of his could have been on the board of control who made the decision whether or not to investigate his behaviour after a complaint. And most of the time, it was a nudge and a wink and a pint of beer in the pub. No, mate, we don't need to go down that route and all that kind of stuff. I mean, absolutely appalling. You missed out, by the way, in your catalogue of disgrace for the Metropolitan Police, the police who worked at Charing Cross Police Station in London, who had a, what do you call that group of people who all, you know, share messages on a, like a...
A WhatsApp group.
There was a group of officers, all male there, about 12 of them, who used to exchange, you know, the most heinous messages about their attitudes to women and the way they would treat them. This all became clear 2 or 3 years ago, and the Metropolitan Commissioner then was a woman, Cressida Dick, did nothing about it. It is utterly appalling. If I ever get stopped by a policeman again for anything, okay, so supposing, you know, a policeman comes to me and says, excuse me, sir, I think you're drunk and disorderly. Excuse me, sir, are you sure you've got a ticket to go on this train? My first question to that police officer, man or woman, would be, have you got a criminal record? Because so many metropolitan police officers actually have criminal records but still serve.
Well, and I read this morning that at least 1,600 police officers are currently being investigated for potential sexual crimes.
Yeah.
How can we be living in the 21st century in 2023 and be having to putting up with this? It's disgusting was the word you used, and I go along with that. It really does. If it were not so tragic, we would be a laughingstock.
I'm just gobsmacked. When I was about 7 years of age or something like that, my mum was in the kitchen and we were in the lounge, you know, we had a semi-detached house in Chester. And all of a sudden we heard this squeal, what's that? And my dad rushed into the kitchen and my mum said that she thought she'd seen a person in our garden. We had a little semi-detached house, a little garden at the back, you know. And, of course, my dad, who served 6 years in the Royal Navy during the war, you know, picked up a torch, opened the back door, went out into the garden, tried to, you know, couldn't find anything, but we rung the police. Anyway, the following morning, at about 9 o'clock, this black Ford Anglia turned up with a police sergeant and a police constable in it. They came in, right, show us the back garden. They looked around. They said, okay, has the gate got a lock on it? Well, no, because we don't normally worry about, you know, sort of intruders in this part of the world. You know, and then sat down, full report. Now, my admiration for the way the police took the concern of my mum so seriously was enormous and shaped my view of the police in this country for the rest of my life. And wherever I've gone in the world, whenever I've spoken, I've said, no, you don't understand. The police in Britain are not corrupt. They are absolutely the best police force in the world. I've changed my mind. I've had to change my mind. The figures that you've just rolled out, I think there's about 4,000 police officers in this country who have some sort of conviction, whether it's for sexual offences or being drunk drivers or theft or something like that. And so many others who belong to groups that clearly are misogynistic, I'm afraid I've completely lost faith in the police in this country.
I can't say I disagree, but I think there's a big power freakery thing going on here. I think a lot of men, and I'm sorry to single out men, but it is overwhelmingly stacked against
men. Women have been charged with any sexual offences in the Metropolitan Police.
Of course they have, but they're few and far between compared.
Well, I don't think,
if you weigh up the numbers,
even one had, actually, but anyway.
But if you take the vast majority of people who, for example, join the army, they join the police force. What is that about? It's a power trip.
Please,
carrying a weapon is a big thing to a lot of these people. It's like owning a big dangerous dog. It's having some aspect to yourself that makes you more powerful and more intimidating towards other people. And this guy, David Carrick, who we're talking about now, was in the habit of getting his weapon out. No pun intended.
Yeah, he was.
And he was in the habit of getting his warrant card out and showing people who he was and what he was capable of.
Yeah, don't you know?
So I really think it's a power thing. And leaning on weaker females who you can scare easily, who can, get this, trap in a cage smaller than you would keep a domestic dog in. Limit the kind of things they can eat, prevent them from talking to their own children, limiting their comings and goings. This is nothing if not power freakery and control.
So if we know all that, and you know all that now, and I know all that, How come that the people who are on the selection board to accept recruits into the police don't do a very thorough job of examining the background of these freaks who want to get in? Because you're absolutely right. The idea that, you know what, I'm going to join the police. Why? Well, you get a warrant card, don't you? You get a uniform. You know, you become somebody in society. You've got a bit of power. In fact, they are just crass bullies, aren't they? And the Metropolitan Police have given them an open door to the bullying fraternity that exists within that force. I'd bloody close it down. I'd close the Metropolitan Police down.
I would have closed it down when Dame Cressida de Dick was in charge. But here's the bit that really took my biscuit, if that's the expression, this morning. When I heard that David Carrick's own mother, Jean, raised concerns about her son when he was a teenager to the local police, and yet he still got into the police force.
I don't know, honestly. So depressing. Anyway, let's move on. And again, not depressing, but clearly something very emotional for you. George Cohen's funeral. George Cohen was the right fullback in the 1966 England World Cup winning team. Sadly passed away after some months. I think he was about 80. But you, in the last couple of days, have been to his funeral, Miss Jones. That must have been very, poignant or whatever.
It really was. George was 83. Yep. So he turned 80 on the day of my own father's funeral.
Amazing.
And we sang happy birthday to George in front of my dad's coffin in the chapel, which a lot of people thought was quite offensive, actually, including my poor mum. But I sort of see it from that point of view. But I also think my father would have led the singing
had he
still been alive. You know, he would have seen the humour in that. Yeah. He and George and my mum, Kathleen, and George's wife, Daphne, were friends for more than 60 years. So it wasn't that they just came together as chums because my dad was reporting on football and George was playing football, had become an international legend and so on. They predated all that. Mm. They'd been friends a long, long time.
Yeah.
And the wonderful thing about George, he never changed. He was always himself. He was a humble, sweet, funny man, and the funeral was humble, sweet, and funny as well. And I just loved it. It wasn't about faces, so you didn't have your Bobby Charlton and your Jeff Hurst. I mean, Bobby lives hundreds of miles away in Manchester, doesn't he? He has dementia.
That's right.
Jeff Hurst, who knows where? It wasn't about.
Sorry to interrupt. Jeff lives in Cheltenham, and Jeff is absolute compass mentis. I think Jeff's 81 now. I may be wrong. 81, 82, but George, Jeff is completely compass mentis.
I wasn't suggesting he wasn't at all.
No, I know you're not, but Bobby Charlton, unfortunately, lives a very quiet, insular life now because he is of a certain age and he does have problems with dementia and all that. So,
yeah, what I'm trying to say, it wasn't a starry event.
No, sure.
It was a humble family funeral. No faces. Only Diddy David Hamilton, you know, he does the announcing at Fulham FC and so on. So he took time out to pay his respects. He's in his 80s. He's just about to celebrate 60 years with the BBC. And he took time out to come and attend. And we did have a bit of a laugh. But I just thought the whole thing was lovely and sweet. And it was a real celebration of George's life. I was very glad to be there.
No, that's great. I mean, that's what you should do, really. I mean, you know, we're all going to end up dead eventually. So
of course we are. You look around, and you look at people's faces and you can tell how frightened some people are thinking, oh God, is it going to be me next?
Well, unfortunately, there's only two left now. And you've just mentioned Bobby Charlton and Jeff Hurst.
No, but I mean, the rest of us, we're all going to go through that.
I totally agree. And, you know, this is a bit of a modern thing to say, but I think of Paul McCartney, you know, he's going to die. I hope I die before him, to be honest. It would break my heart if he did.
No, you don't. We used to say that about the Queen, didn't we? Oh, God, how are we going to live when the Queen dies? We're alive. Yeah. The Queen, God bless her, has died.
Yeah.
We are still alive. And we just have to push on and keep cracking along as best we can, making the most of our days, our weeks, our months, our years, until our time is up.
I totally agree. Talking about people of a good old age, by the way, I've been so, I wouldn't say amused, but so, you know, interested to see Rupert Murdoch, who you and I have both worked for during our newspaper careers. Oh, Rupert there, you know, frolicking on the beach in Barbados at 91 years of age with his new 62-year-old girlfriend. And this is about 3 months after he gave Jerry Hall, his last wife, his fourth wife or fifth wife, $215 million. I mean, he doesn't seem to have given up on the idea of marriage, does he?
Well, do you know, I'll make you laugh. I had 3 phone calls.
Right.
Friends checking out whether I was the bird on the beach in Barbados with Rupert Murdoch.
No.
Because her name is Anne Leslie mine is Leslie Anne.
Oh, right. That's amazing. I didn't pick up on that.
Do you know what I said?
Go on.
I don't care about the billions. I'm fed up, not hard up.
Yeah. That's a bit harsh, isn't it? I also read within the volume of stuff that's been written about him that when Rupert sold the TV studio, 20th Century Fox, to Disney, he gave each of his 6 children $2 billion. Now, you know, this is beyond belief. $2 billion is, in English terms, 16,000 million pounds. And they've all got, I mean, where does wealth end? What is the point of doing anything after you've got that sort of wealth? And how amazing to be able to create that sort of wealth. You know what I mean? It's just mind-boggling, isn't it?
It is mind-boggling. But do you know what I know?
Go on.
Absolutely,
go on.
For sure.
Right.
At this stage in the game, that no number of millions of pounds that you haven't earned personally,
yeah,
is not going to make you happy. And if you want examples of that, look at any rock star child. Look at Lisa Marie Presley.
Well, let's look at her, because, of course, she's died a couple of days ago, tragically, you know, short. Was she 56 or something like that?
54, I think.
Oh, that's right. And apparently died of a broken heart because her son wasn't by Elvis, was?
No, Keogh, her husband, Danny Keogh.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But he committed suicide about 2 years ago. And she never got over it. She became great mates with Austin Butler, who's the brilliant actor who plays her father, Elvis, in the movie by Baz Luhrmann called Elvis. And I remember thinking when that first started up,
yeah,
you know, he became very close to Priscilla, her mother,
yeah,
and to Lisa Marie. And I thought that is an unhealthy relationship, because it was almost like they were projecting their need for Elvis onto this poor young actor,
right,
who's playing a part, after all.
Yeah.
He's not actually reincarnating Elvis, is he?
No, but he played him in a film. I mean, golly, they've been around, you know, the silver screen and La La Land for so long. They can surely separate myth from reality, can't they?
I don't think so. You see, I wonder about that.
Mm.
I think that people become confused. It's like when a leading man and a leading lady play opposite each other in a film,
yeah,
and people always use the expression, they fall in love in real life.
Yes.
You know, they fall for the character,
yeah,
I've always thought, rather than for the actor.
Right.
And that's where it goes wrong, because
yeah,
the real life person can't live up to the character being portrayed.
Mm.
But that's a whole other story. Lisa Marie Presley was an absolute spendthrift, like her father.
Yeah.
But the difference is talent and business sense. So whenever Elvis, who spent an awful lot of money, whenever he ran out, he would just go back out on tour, earn another $10 million, put it all back in the bank,
yeah,
again. She couldn't do that. She was spending like water, the way he did,
yeah,
but she couldn't go out on tour and earn another few million dollars.
She inherited about 60 or 70 million in those days.
More than that, 100 million. She squandered the lot. And it was her mother,
yeah,
Priscilla, who turned,
yeah,
Graceland into a tourist attraction, and it made a fortune.
Right.
And Lisa Marie squandered all that as well.
That's amazing, isn't it?
You know, if you don't have the talent, if you don't have the business acumen,
yeah,
if you don't have the means by which to generate,
yeah,
wealth of your own,
yeah,
this is where it goes wrong. So you can then look at somebody like James McCartney, for example,
yeah,
who strummed a bit of guitar, tried a bit of songwriting. He's never gone anywhere with it. And the reason he hasn't is because his father is Paul McCartney, yeah, and his father is dishing out the dosh.
Yeah. Well, Paul McCartney's got a lot of dosh. I think he's a billionaire, isn't he? Which is not as rich as Rupert Murdoch, but it's still very rich in those sort of terms.
And you can't take it with you.
You can't take it with you. Elvis's favourite moniker, or whatever you want to call it, his initials were TCB, taking care of business, wasn't it? And yep. And he had what he called the Mafia, Mississippi Mafia, was it, or something like that?
Memphis Mafia, wasn't
Memphis
it?
Mafia, thank you very much. And they were just the good old boys, and they were just literally his old mates who just surrounded him just to keep him company, you know.
Well, yeah, paying your friends. So he just literally would pay them to sit around.
That's right, yeah.
Well, they weren't sitting around the night he fell off the toilet after overdosing on drugs, were they? Where were they? No. Downstairs watching television.
No, they weren't. Amazing, isn't it? Yeah. Right. Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for listening in today on, well, at the moment as well, not just today, because we are 24 hours a day here on Life on Planet Porky, myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, there's one thing I don't quite understand, but you will understand better. I'm sorry that we're having to talk about so many people who are no longer with us. You know, we've already done George Cohen and we've already done Elvis and all that. But Jeff Beck died, and I read all the obituaries. The greatest guitarist ever. Really? Because I only remember Jeff Beck for Hi-Ho, Silver Lining, and whatever it was. And apparently that's...
Anywhere You Go.
Everywhere You Go. That's the only song he ever made. He hated it.
No, it's not the only song he ever made. Of course it's not the only song he ever made. He didn't particularly like that song. It emerged from a period in his life when he was between bands, because you may not remember that he was in the Yardbirds back in the 60s alongside Eric Clapton and so on.
I don't. I'm too young.
He then had his own band, the Jeff Beck Band. In between, he was in the Faces with Rod Stewart and so on.
Yeah.
He got in with a producer, record producer called Mickey Most at one point.
Yeah, I remember Mickey Most. Oh, yeah.
Prolific pop producer. Absolutely. And he got together with Jeff and they released that song. It was an instant hit, a jukebox classic.
Yeah.
They re-released it in the 70s. It was a hit all over again. And it became the thing that defined Jeff Beck because the public couldn't put a label on him. He was known within the industry as the guitarist.
Yeah.
He played with everybody, you name them, Hans Zimmer, Tina Turner, Kate Bush.
Yeah.
He lined up alongside so many people. The Rolling Stones wanted him. They invited him to replace Brian Jones after Brian died in 69.
That's right.
He turned them down.
That's right.
And also Pink Floyd asked, well, they wanted him to replace Syd Barrett, but none of them had the nerve to go and ask him because he was fierce, he was grumpy, he was his own man. He never chased fame and fortune. And for that reason, he never became a household name.
Yeah, well, he was so admired within the industry. He described the Rolling Stones as a quaint band, I read, you know, when he was offered it. No. What he meant was they produced like 3-minute, you know, singles in those days, you know, like, you know, Hey, Hey, You, You'd Get Off of My Cloud and all that. And he was apparently the most gifted guitarist whose fingers, you know, went so nimbly over the, is it called the fretboard, the long bit of a guitar, is it?
Yes. But it wasn't just about that. It wasn't about strings. It was about tremolo arms. It was about technique.
Yeah.
It was, you know, they always do these polls, don't they, in magazines like Rolling Stone and so on. And they put, you know, the top 5 guitarists of all time, rock guitarists.
Yeah.
And I think that he's usually about number 5 on the list. I personally would say you'd put him at the joint number 1 slot with Jimi Hendrix.
Right, okay.
And then who have you got underneath
Jimmy
that? You've got Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, Pete Townsend.
Yeah.
That's kind of it, isn't it, really?
And George Harrison doesn't get enough credit, you know, in that league.
That's true as well.
Yeah.
But it's a small number. And I think the fact that not one single fellow guitarist had a bad word to say about him ever.
No, not at all.
Is testimony in itself, isn't it? He was a lovely guy. I had a wild night out with him and his former manager, Simon Napier-Bell.
Where was that?
I was in the Groucho. So I was having dinner with Simon.
Yeah.
Simon is famous for having managed the Yardbirds, Wham, George Michael as a solo artist, Mark Bolan, all kinds.
Cool.
And he's my best friend, actually. Sorry to disappoint you, Mr. Parry, but we've been very good friends for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And he lives in Thailand.
Yeah.
So whenever he comes over, we have a few wild nights. We happen to be having one of our wild nights in the Groucho Club, and in walked Jeff Beck. And he and Simon hadn't seen each other for donkey's years.
Right.
And they just fell on each other like long-lost brothers. And we ended up having this... I think we... We solved the problems of the world that night.
Yeah, wonderful.
And Jeff Beck didn't hold back. He was a lovely, lovely person. Yeah. Vegetarian, long before it was trendy to be vegetarian.
Right.
He loved his classic cars. He could pull cars to bits.
That's right. He had a big mansion, didn't he, in East Sussex. The garages were full of classic cars that he used to roll around.
And it was a wild life. Well, he used to be a panel beater, actually, before he became a professional guitarist, you see. Right. So he never lost that passion for cars. Mm, mm. And he was just a simple all-round bloke. He was married six times, mind you.
He's married six times, was he?
The six wives of Jeffrey Beck.
I read one of the tributes to him, and it was a rock writer. I don't know who it was, but he was interviewing Jeff Beck, and all of a sudden the phone rang, okay? And it was the early days of mobile phones. And he said, oh, I don't know who the fuck this is, all that kind of stuff. You know, he looked at it, he said, oh, it's Eric. And it was Eric Clapton. And then the conversation went like this. Yeah, okay, Eric, I'll do that with you. Yeah, all right, mate. But listen, I'm doing all the riffs. You can just do the fill-ins. Is that okay? Yeah, good. And put the phone down on him. I mean, imagine talking to Eric Clapton like that.
Yeah, Eric Clapton's a bit thick, actually. Sorry to say. He's not the most... You know, people used to say, Steve, interesting Davis.
Oh, yes, yes.
We used to say, Eric, interesting Clapton, because he really wasn't at all.
Really? That's really a bit harsh, isn't it, Miss?
A little bit, yeah.
When you're talking about a guy like that. Miss Jones, I'm very pleased to see that the era of the electric car is disappearing massive style. A, they're too expensive. B, they're too heavy. C, you can't charge them. And D, a company in the northeast of England that was set up to produce the batteries for electric cars, which are huge, by the way, about 10 times the size of a battery in a conventional car, has gone bust because demand has slipped because Jeff Bezos, who, of course, was the initial electric car man with, what was his car's called? Tesla. Tesla. Is now,
aren't you talking about Elon Musk?
Elon, who did I say?
You said Jeff Bezos.
No. Jeff Bezos is Amazon, isn't he? You're absolutely
right. Yeah, Elon Musk.
Elon Musk, and that all seems to be going south. But I have to say, to me, the electric car has just been an absolutely ridiculous dream that would come true. But as I've said many times on many broadcasting shows, if every car in this country depended on electricity, we'd have to build another 10 new nuclear power stations to fund it. We haven't got enough electricity to keep the national grid going if it gets really cold, so we'd be in real trouble.
Well, we haven't. It's interesting. When I was looking up some bits and pieces about this, I had no idea. My accountant, right?
Yes.
Not my accountant. No, let's not talk about Nelson. Let's talk about my tech guy, who helps me with my my websites and all my computer tech and everything.
Yeah.
Wonderful guy called Dan. He drives a Tesla, a Model 3. I must be paying this guy too much. Do you know how much one of those costs new?
They're about 80,000, aren't they?
48,500, the one he's driving.
There you go.
48,500 quid. But I also read that there was a 38% increase in sales of electric cars in the year to the end of October just gone.
Right.
And that's 38% up on sales the previous year.
Right.
So people are buying these things.
Yeah, but they can't charge them. There's no charging points. And do you know, in Nottingham, they've had to ban electric cars from multi-storey car parks because they're so heavy that if more than about a dozen or 15 or 20 appear on the same floor, the multi-storey car park is in danger of collapsing because they were engineered only for cars built in the 1960s, 1970s, you know, which weigh the same as a Vauxhall Viva or a Ford Cortina.
I imagine if I had a 48.5 grand car, I probably wouldn't park it in a public car park.
Well, you'd have to park it somewhere if you went shopping, you know what I mean? And those...
I can't see that all these people who've invested in electric cars are all going to be losing out because they can't get a battery. It's going to get it from somewhere, surely.
Well, I think I've told this story already, haven't I, on the Planet Porky podcast. Old broadcasting colleague of mine, Ian Dale, I think he lives in Kent and he's got a holiday home in Norfolk. It's quite a long journey, you know, he makes and all that kind of stuff. And it would normally take him something like three and a half hours. He bought an electric car and it took him 11 hours. Through having to try and find charging points, for having to wait in a queue to get his car charged, 40 minutes to charge the car. Ian, if I'm misrepresenting you in any way, I apologise. But it was a horror story. And he concluded by saying, I've put the electric car back in the garage until things get better. But anyway, that's another story. We just talked about the Rolling Stones and an old Jeff, what's his name, the great guitarist.
Jeff Beck.
Jeff Beck. I noticed the other day a guy called Mick Taylor celebrated his 74th birthday. He was the guy who went to the Stones after Brian Jones died, wasn't he?
Mick did, yes. He was 25 when he joined the Rolling Stones.
Right.
And he performed alongside the rest of the band at the infamous Hyde Park concert in commemoration of Brian Jones.
2 days after
he died.
Brian Jones died?
Yeah. Yeah, it was July 69. Yeah, but he sort of fell foul of the whole thing, really, because when they went down to the south of France to record the famous double album Exile on Main Street, he was with his new young mom, not his mom, but he was together with Rose, his girlfriend, who later became his wife. They had a new baby. Mick Taylor was seduced by Mick Jagger on that trip.
What?
And things were never the same again.
Good God, too much information on Planet Porky here, Miss Jones. I mean,
sorry, family show, but that's what happened. Yeah. And he kind of lost his marbles. He went off the rails not long after that.
Really?
Because he just could not reconcile what he'd done, his betrayal of Rose and of their child. And he wound up as a recluse. He got no money. He was responsible for some of the great riffs, guitar riffs on that album. Yes. And he was never credited. Some of the lyrics he came up with wasn't credited. He did not earn the money he deserved. Oh. And he ended up sort of a recluse, I think up Suffolk, Norfolk, somewhere like that.
Yeah.
Living in a shed, doing the old gig down a local pub, driving an old clapped out old banner, lost touch with his daughter. So his life has not been a success. And his brush with the Rolling Stones didn't really do it for him.
Yeah, well, it didn't. I think anybody who came into the Stones after the original never shared in the massive profits, did they? They were paid as almost like session musicians, weren't they? I think Ronnie Wood was as well.
To a point, yes, for quite a number of years. But then Ronnie got taken on as kind of part of the board, of the firm, if you like, in the end. Yeah. He's been there, 47 years? He's still the new boy.
Unbelievable, isn't it? Yeah. Absolutely. Now, we have to have a Beatles story, Miss Jones.
Of course.
We do. A shocking aeroplane crash in Nepal this week. And the aeroplane, there were a lot of people on it, and it crashed and smashed up. But it had taken off from Kathmandu. Now, one of my favourite Lennon songs after the Beatles split up was Nobody Told Me There'd Be Days Like These. Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Nobody told me there were days like these. Great days indeed, and all that kind of stuff, right? But not bad,
actually.
Thank you. One at the end of one of the, you know, the verses in that is there's a little man going up in Kathmandu. It's a very specific Lennon, you know, message about Kathmandu, you know what I mean? And of course, Kathmandu is in Nepal, and this plane had taken off from Kathmandu, and I now don't like Kathmandu anymore. I used to love it because Lennon made it famous in that song. But did you realise that planes that fly with that airline, Nepal Airways...
It was Yeti Airways, wasn't
Yeti
it?
Yeti Airways are banned from Europe because their safety record is so appalling, even the European Union will not allow them to fly across European airspace. If that's the case, why were they allowed to fly anywhere anyway?
And if that's the case, why would you get on one in the first place?
Exactly.
I mean, the very name says it all, doesn't it? Yeti Airways. I mean, the Yeti is a mythical creature.
No.
Nobody actually knows whether it exists.
No, I know.
I don't mean to make light of this terrible tragedy.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it is utterly ridiculous, isn't it? And, of course, that brought me back to, Kathmandu, John Lennon, Everest, of course, is in the Himalayas and all that. And I went back to the story about... Why, in fact, this was brought up in a publication you might have read this week. When did Abbey Road become Abbey Road. I'm talking about the studios, obviously, because they used to be in EMI, North London Recording Studios, didn't they? And then,
yeah, it was always known as EMI, and it changed its name after the success of the Beatles album called Abbey Road.
But not until 6 years later. Yeah. Unbelievably, but, you know.
Well after, yeah, but it was always known as EMI Recording Studios.
That's right. But anyway, I get back to the original story. It's a story I love. The Beatles LP Abbey Road, which I think is famous for not having the name of the group or the name of the title of the album on the front or back cover. There was like no words whatsoever, right?
It's on the spine there.
On the side? I didn't know that. Is that right?
On the spine, yeah.
Well done, yeah, okay. But apparently that was originally going to be called Everest. And the reason it wasn't called Everest was because none of the Beatles fancied hopping on a plane and going to the Himalayas to have their picture taken on Everest, the mountain. But what I found out in the piece I read this week was that they weren't going to call it Everest because of Everest, the mountain. The sound engineer, whoever he was, smoked these foreign cigarettes called Everest, right? And he just looked at the packet of his cigarettes and said, let's call it Everest.
Oh, that would have been Jeff Emmerich, I should
maybe
think.
Maybe
would have been their engineer at that point. Yeah. And that's very possible. But I thought you were going to tell me something even more obscure, that maybe he'd had his double glazing fitted by Everest or something like that.
No, well, that could have been it. But the other tale to this story is that previously, when I've read about how Abbey Road happened and how the famous picture happened on the zebra crossing, it was Ringo who said, no, I don't want to go to Everest. I don't want to go to the Himalayas. If we can't decide what to do, why don't we just go out onto the road and take a picture on the road?
Why don't we do it in the road?
Say again.
Why don't we do it in the road?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Mitch McCartney wrote as a song, of course. But in the latest version of that, I'm told it was Paul McCartney's idea, not Ringo's. I'm not sure about that. Are you?
Yeah, well, they don't remember. I mean, Paul McCartney, bless him, rewrites history all the time.
Right, okay.
And I think we can sort of allow for that because we do change our minds about things when we look back over events and happenings in our own lives.
Well, certainly
lives,
Prince
we?
Harry and Meghan do, that's for sure.
Well, they're quite good at that, yes.
Yeah, well, we won't get into that for all right.
Well, I think,
far too much of that all the time. Listen, Miss Jones, you were always hailed. And without trying to embarrass you or anything like that, as a Fleet Street beauty in your day.
Oh, thank you.
There were lots of them around, Carol Malone, you know, and yourself. And
well, Carol Malone was terribly glamorous compared to me.
She was very glam indeed. But anyway, the reason I bring all that up is because Gina Lollar Bridger has died. This sounds like a blinking sort of, you know, that's the second or third person we've talked about who's died.
This is a roll call of death, this podcast.
Roll call of those who've gone. But I read up on Gina Lollobrigida, and I mean...
Gina Lollobrigida, whose real name was Luigia.
Oh, was it?
I never knew that until this week.
I didn't know that either. But, you know, she had this incredible rivalry with...
I thought you were going to say she had this incredible rack.
Well,
she did actually have a gigantic chest, or as my father used to call it, significant bazooms.
Very significant, and apparently used to get into boasting sessions with Marilyn Monroe, who had the most, which of them had the most impressive bust, you know what I mean, all that kind of stuff. And quite frankly, I wouldn't have minded entertaining either of them, no matter the size of their bust. I mean, but all I'm saying is...
Family show, Mike.
Family show. All I'm saying is that Gina Lollobrigida, or is it Lollobrigida?
Yeah.
Lollobrigida. I mean, she was famous for being beautiful and little else, really, wasn't she?
Well, she made a lot of films, actually.
Yeah, but she
was an international sex symbol. No, but guess why? Because it was Howard Hughes who bought her up, actually.
Yes.
And contracted her to make films.
Yes.
During the golden age of Hollywood. And the expectation was that she would move to America and make films for his studio and so on. She refused to leave Europe.
Yeah.
So the majority of the films she made were Italian and French.
Yeah.
Howard Hughes sold the studios eventually. Mm. But he kept hold of her contract, very interestingly.
Wow.
And it wasn't until the tail end. So her highest profile was during the 50s and 60s, well before our time.
Yeah.
But by the end, towards the end of her film career. She was making films opposite Humphrey Bogart, Errol Flynn, Burt Lancaster, Tony Curtis, Anthony Quinn. Yeah. And I've actually seen two of her films. She was in Never So Few with Frank Sinatra. Mm-hmm. And that was one of my mum's favourites. My mum used to watch black and white films on a Saturday afternoon.
Lovely.
So I got into a bit of that when I was a kid. And she did Solomon and Sheba with Yul Brynner, which you may remember.
No, I don't. But I remember Yul Brynner, yeah.
But by the 70s, which is where we were sort of coming in. Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, that was later. But but come the 1970s, it was mostly all over for her, you see. And then she became a photojournalist.
Yeah.
And her big claim to fame was an interview with Fidel Castro.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I wonder why.
Yeah, well, maybe he liked significant bazooms as well.
Well, he was a mega shagger, wasn't he? As we know, Fidel Castro.
Allegedly. Alleged Brigida.
Yeah, well, he's dead now, so he can't sue us. But no, I mean, he was well known, wasn't he? One of the great exercises of his power was to pick the maidens that he fancied, so to speak. But
dear. Thing.
Listen, just before we go, and thanks to everybody for listening today, I'm very upset with my football club, Everton. I'm a friend of Mr. Kenwright, the chairman, and I've had a close relationship with the club all my life, but more particularly in the last 25 years while I've been in broadcasting. I was very, very upset that the board chose not to visit our last game against Southampton when we lost 2-1 because of some threats that had been made to members of the board. Every time I go to Goodison, Leslie Ann Wright, I get threats. It's just part of life, you know. You know, we're waiting for you, Porky. You know, don't show your face in Liverpool. You know, we know when your train's coming in at Lime Street. We'll be waiting for you. And you just have to ignore them because they're all like cowardly, faceless nutters.
I'm deeply shocked to hear that. So you're actually getting
all the time
life-threatening messages from people waiting for your train to come in.
I wouldn't say life-threatening in the sense that we're going to kill you and all that, but it's always, we'll be waiting for you, Paul. Don't you show your face at Goodison Park again. You're not wanted here. You'll find out if you make the mistake of turning up today and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Do you know the names of the people who are saying this stuff?
Of course you don't. It's just
So is this on Twitter? Where are you seeing all this
stuff? On Twitter all the time. They're all tweet accounts. And many...
Well, why don't you conduct an experiment and take your complaint along to the Metropolitan Police?
Well, I suppose I could, except most of them probably to the northwest of England. And to be honest, if I reported every one of those I got, I'd have nothing else to do in 24 hours of a day. You know what I mean? But my view is that Everton are in very bad shape at the moment. The team's not doing well on the pitch. And what you really need is strong leadership. And I have to say, and I sent Mr. Kenwright a note saying, please tell me you are not going to accept the advice of your security team and not go to Goodison today, because you have to be there and we have to show leadership. And so that's a bit of a problem. We're playing, by the time our millions of listeners are listening to this, you'll be 2 or 3 days away from Everton's next game, which is at West Ham on Saturday this week. I will definitely be there. I hope the ward will as well.
It's surprising about Mr. Kenwright because he's such a strong, large, forthright character. Doesn't take anything from anybody.
Absolutely.
He stands up to people. I have great admiration for him. And I'm surprised that he would buckle at something like this.
Well, I'm not going to say he buckled. I'm going to, you know, Mr. Kenwright's a man of a certain age now, and he has had health problems over the last 3 or 4 years. And it may well have been that he decided the stress factor could just be too great. And if anything happened and he had rejected the advice of the security people, he would have caused a problem himself. You see what I mean? So I'm not blaming Mr. Kenwright, but other members of the board are considerably younger. And it just sits uneasily with me, that's all. I'm not making accusations and all that. Would I have been brave enough to go, yes, I would, because I'd have said you've got a stone down. Anyway, there you go. Thank you very much indeed, everyone. Sorry, couldn't my words out there. Thank you very much indeed.
Try that again, Mike.
Again. Thank you very much indeed, everybody, for listening. It's been myself, the Portmeister, and Ms. Leslie Ann Jones here on Life on Planet Porky. And we'll be back with you, hopefully, in the same freezing temperature this time next week. this is a bit of a modern thing to say, but I think of, like, you know, well, Paul McCartney, you know, he's going to die. I hope I die before him, to be honest. It'd break my heart if he did.
No, you don't. We used to say that about the Queen, didn't we? Oh, God, how are we going to live when the Queen dies? We're alive. Yeah. The Queen, God bless her, has died. Yeah. We are still alive. And we just have to push on and keep cracking along as best we can, making the most of our days, our weeks, our months, our years, until our time is up.
I totally agree. But, you know, she had this incredible rivalry with...
I thought you were going to say she had this incredible rack.
Well,
she did actually have a gigantic chest, or as my father used to call it, significant bazooms.
Very significant, and apparently used to get into boasting sessions with Marilyn Monroe, who had the most, which of them had the most impressive bust, you know what I mean? All that kind of stuff. And quite frankly, I wouldn't have minded entertaining either of them, no matter the size of their bust. I mean, but all I'm saying...
Family show, Mike.
Family show.
Clapton's a bit thick, actually. Sorry to say. He's not the most... You know, people used to say, Steve, interesting Davis.
Oh, yes, yes.
We used to say, Eric, interesting Clapton, because he really wasn't at all.
Really? That's really a bit harsh, isn't it, Miss?
A little bit, yeah.
When you're talking about a guy like that.